You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, Democrats are calling on Joe Biden to address sexual assault allegations against him. Meanwhile, other members of the party are defending the likely nominee for president. We'll look at what he's being accused of and what it means for the Me Too movement. Now, we can see birds all year long here in Wisconsin, although late spring is a particularly fun time. That's especially true when so many of us are at home during the day and can actually enjoy the ones who might be coming to our yards and our feeders. Craig Thompson works for DNR's Natural Heritage Conservation Program. Much of his career has focused on migratory bird conservation, and his work was featured in the PBS Wisconsin documentary Our Birds. He lives on Wisconsin's west coast, a little north of La Crosse. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Keely. I'm delighted to join you today.
We are here on the last day of April. What birds are we seeing migrate through Wisconsin right now?
Oh, my gosh. There are just all kinds of birds that are coming in every day. This is, as you had mentioned, a really fun time of year. It's incredibly exciting as it relates to migration. So just a little bit of perspective. Migration actually begins in March with the return of birds that are considered to be super hardy. The geese, the cranes, the waterfowl all come back as the marshes start to open up and the rivers and start to de-ice. And then in April, what we see is the first influx of what we consider to be short-distance migrants as it relates to songbirds. So we see bluebirds coming back and hermit thrushes passing through and robins. Those are all smaller birds that aren't quite as hardy as the first wave of migrants, but are still pretty tough because, as you know, weather can take a turn for the worse now and then in April, and they have to be tough enough to be able to endure. But the curtain on migration really lifts in May, and that's when we see an influx of all kinds of spectacular birds. Literally, thousands of birds will pass through our state over the next few weeks, representing hundreds of species. And it's a show that is not to be missed. So right now, we've got charming little white-throated sparrows that are singing every morning as they head north to the northern forests of Wisconsin and Minnesota and southern Canada to breed. I saw my first blue-gray gnatcatcher today. A couple of days ago, we were blessed with our first sighting of a rose-breasted grosbeak at our sunflower seed feeder. And for those who don't know what a grosbeak is, it's a spectacular songbird that looks like it's clad in formal wear with a bright red ascot. It's just got a wonderful song. It actually sounds much like a robin that has taken singing lessons. So it one-ups a robin in the song category.
And Craig, we can actually hear that quick.
If
we pause for just a moment, we can actually hear the rose-breasted grosbeak quick. If you want to take a listen to it, here it is.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so we can hear kind of how, you might say, it might sound similar to other birds that you're familiar with, certainly. And you've seen these now.
And we're seeing those now. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing reports of hummers coming back and Baltimore Orioles coming back. And again, over the next, migration will crescendo right up until mid-May, which is considered the peak. And within the next couple of weeks, there'll be all sorts of things that we haven't seen since last summer that are going to just be a delight to watch again.
Craig Thompson is pointing out some birds that he's seeing and we might be saying, and you're part of this conversation. We're talking about birds and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing in your yard at your feeders right now? Are they the usual suspects or have you noticed something rare or spectacular? Maybe you've got birds that come back every year or you've noticed something new. Give us a call. Let us know. 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's talk about different kinds of feeders and what to put in them. Craig, I have to admit, I don't have any in my yard, but we have been spending more time at home and we've been thinking about it. Where do we even start? Because there are a lot of models and a lot of options.
Well, there are all sorts of feeders that you can put out, and it just depends on what kind of birds you'd like to attract. The traditional feeders are those that offer some kind of seed, particularly for the birds that decide to stay through the winter. So there are a variety of tube feeders that you can fill with peanut chips or with sunflower seeds or with safflower seed that will attract seed-eating birds. In spring, a lot of people like to put out nectar feeders. So they put out sugar water feeders that provide food for hummingbirds as they come in to set up shop. And then some folks also put out feeders for orioles. Orioles are black and orange members of the blackbird family, just a lovely bird, and they respond really well to orange color. So if you put a feeder out that has oranges in it or is an orange-colored feeder that has trays of grape jelly, you're likely to attract orioles during migration. And it's a great way to see an otherwise a bird that's otherwise kind of often very difficult to see because it frequents the treetops. And so that those are all good ways to attract birds during migration. One of the things that we do here at our house, Keely, is put out two bird baths, and I keep them filled with fresh water every day. During dry times, you know, birds migrate no matter what the weather, but when it gets a little dry or if it gets hot, they're really looking for sources of water. And we have seen spectacular things drop in to take a quick drink and a quick bath as they're headed north to Canada during migration. And so standing water or moving water, if you have that kind of feature, are really good ways to attract migratory birds as well.
Depending on where we are in Wisconsin, should we be focused or trying to attract certain kinds of birds, or can we, you know, kind of think of it more broadly as far as what's going through or, you know, finding a home here in Wisconsin right now?
I think we can think of it more broadly. So just to have the right kinds of feeders out to attract species, the most important thing that people can do long-term, and of course this isn't a quick-term fix for this migration season, but from a longer-term perspective, to plant your yard with native species. So native trees, native shrubs, and native plants are all going to be very attractive to birds. And it's literally a situation where if you plant it, they will come. Birds respond to habitat structure. What I mean by that is if you put trees in, you're going to get tree-loving birds that will eventually show up. If you put shrubs in, birds that are attracted to shrubs will arrive in your yard and so on. So you can plant your yard to make it a bird oasis and have very gratifying results in just a handful of years.
And you talked about making sure that you have fresh water in the bird baths. What about feeders? Should we be cleaning those, or is there anything specific we need to do to take care of those so birds have a safe place to eat?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Keely. So it's feeder hygiene is extremely important. You want to make sure that your feeders are cleaned usually about once a week, and I use a weak bleach solution to take the feeder down and scrub it and then rinse it thoroughly so there isn't any residue on it, and then you can put it back up. I don't recommend a bleach solution for hummingbird feeders per se. I just really use a warm, soapy water to clean those out and make sure. And you have to be on top of these hummingbird feeders because the sugar water, when it gets hot during midsummer, can really go bad very rapidly. So within a matter of 2, 3, 4 days, it can start to grow mildew. So you have to keep those scrubbed out. And I use warm water and soap for that and just make sure that the hummingbird mix is always fresh. By the way, people do not need to use red dye in their hummingbird mix. A simple mixture of four cups of water to one cup of granulated sugar is going to be sufficient. And the feeders have red on them, and so you don't need to put any dye in the food whatsoever.
Thanks for those tips.
But keeping those feeders clean is important, as is that clean water and bird baths as well.
Okay, we'll try to stay on top of it for sure. Talking with Craig Thompson of the DNR right now about late spring birding in Wisconsin. And there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. What birds are you seeing in your part of Wisconsin right now? If you're home more than usual, are you getting a chance to see more visitors to your backyard? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You could also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you're a lifelong birder, what tips and advice do you have to share with people who might just be getting started? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. There's room for you in this conversation. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Thanks for being with us here on Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. We are talking with Craig Thompson of the DNR about late spring birding in Wisconsin, and your experiences are welcome. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What birds are you seeing in your backyard? Maybe you've taken a social distanced walk and seen something new or something you haven't seen in a really long time. Give us a call. Let us know what that was like at 800-642-1234. 1234. And we've got Phyllis from the town of Dunn ready to talk with us now. Hey, Phyllis.
Hi, thank you. Well, my grandmother used to keep hummingbird feeders, and when she came back home to her house after being away, they would come up to her and buzz in the face as if to say, well, where is it? Where's that food? But as wonderful as that was, I don't feed hummingbirds sugar water because I wouldn't feed my children sugar water, and I think it must be bad for them to be eating all that candy, so to speak, and not what they're supposed to eat. This is as far away from a native flower as you can get, sugar water.
Interesting, Phyllis. Thanks so much for that. Craig Thompson, is it like feeding hummingbirds candy all the time, all day, every day?
Well, Phyllis raises a good point, but nectar is, in terms of its sugar content, is not that much different than sugar water. So to some degree, sugar water mimics what's available from plants. It gives the birds an added boost. I'm not aware of anything that indicates that sugar water is, in fact, nutritionally bad for hummingbirds. It's interesting to note that when they're actually breeding, they eat a lot of insects, and much of the food that they need to feed their young are insects because of the protein and the fats associated with that. So while the sugar water is more just a carbohydrate for them, it is important, particularly during migration, to give them a boost. I suspect that on a limited basis, there are some hummingbirds that probably make it through extremely cold nights in early Wisconsin because of availability of feeders in their neighborhood. And while we don't think that feeding has an impact on wild bird populations in general, for individual birds, it may actually benefit them. But on balance, I don't think that there are downsides to feeding hummingbirds sugar water. And in fact, if it brings joy and people can help connect birds, and that then leads to additional actions for bird conservation, I think that can be something that's considered extremely beneficial.
Phyllis, thanks so much for giving us a call at 800-642-1234. Now, Kathy from Madison wants to join the conversation. Welcome, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I have two things. I got so excited about my Oreos coming. I made 2 quarts of sugar water about a month ago, but I put it in the refrigerator. Is that still good, or should I dump it and make some new stuff?
Okay, first question from Kathy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, hey, Kathy, it's a great question. My inclination would be to dump it and make new stuff. Even sugar water, even if refrigerated for a long period of time, can start to develop mold. If you hold it up to the light, you might see a thin film of mold floating around. And I've had that happen with sugar water that we've made. So, you know, we usually make a new batch every week just because it's inexpensive and it's important that it be as healthy as possible for the birds, to the extent that sugar water can be. So you're better off just making a new batch and getting it out there.
Okay. And Kathy, you had something else you wanted to say or ask, right?
I did. And I'll do that. I'll dump that. So my second one is last year around this time, I had some indigo buntings. And I had some red-breasted grosbeak, and I had, of course, my yellow finches, which I love. This year, and my Oreos, this year, I'm not seeing. I saw one yellow finch, and I have a bunch of blackbirds at my feeder. I put that white seed out there that's supposed to, like, deter them from coming around the feeders. But I'm not seeing any of my other birds. Well, what are those black ones that are coming around? Blackbirds and sparrows.
All right. Thanks, Kathy. What do you think, Greg?
So, Kathy, there are a variety of blackbirds that learn to frequent feeders, and it's hard to know without getting into a detailed description or a more detailed description what exactly they would be. It may be a function, with you not seeing the other birds yet, of timing. April was pretty cold from a migratory bird standpoint, and it really has slowed things down. And what we're seeing are a lot of birds that are just starting to arrive now, some right on time, others a little bit late. And so we saw our first indigo bunting here just a couple of days ago. And as I'd mentioned earlier, our first rose-breasted grosbeak just came in a couple of days ago. So I suspect if you still have your feeders out and the habitat in and adjacent to your yard hasn't changed substantially, you still stand a darn good chance of seeing all of those great birds that you saw last spring. And so fingers crossed that it's just a matter of time before they arrive in your yard.
And you may also be able to hear them. We actually have the sound of the indigo bunting here. Let's take a listen. There it is again. Craig, when we're looking for the indigo bunting, what characteristics are we trying to watch for?
Well, you're watching for a little bitty electric blue bird that sits on top of or on the side of a tree, typically on the forest edge, and sings his little heart out. It's a great song. It's very vigorous. And indigo buntings are one of the species that have a tendency to sing well into summer, sometimes even into late summer. So normally what happens is birdsong, much like migration, begins to crescendo, and then it peaks in June when the peak of breeding activity is underway. And then as birds finish having families, they start to quiet down. Indigo buntings and just a few other species, however, remain really vocal. And so that's one of the species that you can look for this midsummer that's still singing from the tops of trees. If you get it in good, bright light, it's going to be electric blue. If you see it in poor light, in dim light, it might look like just a little dark bird, but it's the song that will help give it away. And, you know, and Kathy had mentioned that she had them at her feeder. We have one at our feeder. And right now, with the vegetation not being fully leafed out, the trees are just starting to bud now. It's a great time to see these birds because you don't have to look through the vegetation in order to find them. They're much more visible.
We're talking about birds with Craig Thompson. He spent much of his career focused on migratory bird conservation, and we're also taking calls from you, including from Russ in Stoughton. Hi, Russ.
Hi. I'm about 15 miles southwest of Madison, and for about the last, since I moved here from Illinois, about the last 13, 14 years, I have hung up Baltimore Oriole feeders, and I use the pre-mixed red liquid you can get at stores and hardware stores. And I've had 10, 12 pairs sometimes, and I can count them in the trees and the bushes. Last year, I only had about 4. And this year, so far, I have had none. And the other comment I wanted to make is that about 4 or 5 years ago, I noticed that the little black and white woodpeckers are landing on the oriole feeders because it has bigger holes, and they're drinking out of there all the time. I wonder if anybody else sees that.
Thanks for that caller, Russ. We really appreciate it. What do you think, Craig?
Well, in regard, Russ, to the diminishment of orioles at your property, it's hard to know within a short period of time what exactly is going on. Again, if things are pretty stable in terms of the vegetation that you're finding in your area, it could just be that sometimes birds are more abundant in areas. Some years they're less so. And so we see those fluctuations within bird communities. From a much longer term perspective, however, what we're seeing are declines of a lot of species for a number of reasons. And so we know that there are a third fewer orioles than there used to be. So there just aren't as many out there. And again, that's a conservation concern to the Department of Natural Resources and lots of other conservation organizations. And we're trying to get a handle on that. So it could be a reflection of just the fact that there are fewer orioles out there, or it could be that they just didn't show up this year yet at your place, and there just weren't as many the year before. So fingers crossed that as your yard vegetation continues to mature and you have feeders out there, you're going to continue to see orioles. Now, in regard to your comment about downies, birds are very clever little animals, and they keep an eye on what's going on out there. I actually have seen downy woodpeckers and, on occasion, some migrating warblers take a sip out of a hummingbird feeder, and it's a great little burst of energy for them. And so the downy that's clever enough to figure out how to drink nectar has really hit the jackpot from a dietary standpoint, at least until that hummingbird feeder is no longer out there. So once in a while you see those birds do that, and that's pretty neat. That indicates how adaptable they are to their environment.
Now, Russ from Monroe, Wisconsin, is ready to join our conversation. Welcome to the Ideas Network, Russ.
Thank you. Hi. We've been feeding birds continuously for about 5 years at our house, winter and summer, with circulating water during winter. And we've seen already goldfinches, downy woodpeckers, red-bellied sapsuckers, flickers. We saw a brown thrasher and a female grosbeak recently, and I think we have about 3-4 nesting robins, and I'm pretty sure this old female has been back for about the fourth year. At least it looks like the similar bird, and she looks a little older. But I was wondering about the brown thrashers. I've read that they're in decline also, and we only see them now and then.
All right. Thanks for the question, Russ. Craig, what do you know about the brown thrasher?
Yeah, Russ, it sounds like you've got a good handle on birds in your area, and you're right. Thrashers are in a rather steep decline. It's a lovely bird that's associated with forest edges and brushy old fields, and it's something that it's a species we're quite concerned about because they are, again, in rather steep decline for a variety of reasons. And so if you still have thrashers at your property, if your property supports a pair or even birds during migration, that's really important. And that's something that we want to know about. And so one of the things the way any citizen can or interested bird watcher can help with the conservation of these declining species in particular is to contribute your sightings to a Cornell Lab of Ornithology site called eBird, where you can go in and electronically enter all those birds that you're seeing and all that data that's coming in from birders throughout the nation and, in fact, across the world is really helping us to understand where birds are, how they're faring population-wise, and so on. So any records, Russ, that you're willing to contribute to eBird would be helpful for those species that you're finding on the property, including the brown thrasher.
Oh, how great. Craig Thompson, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Keely. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. Craig Thompson works for DNR's Natural Heritage Conservation Program. Much of his career has focused on migratory bird conservation. And you can stream the documentary titled Our Birds about Craig's work with birds this summer in Wisconsin and winter in Central America by going to the PBS Wisconsin site, which is pbswisconsin.org. And if you are seeing more birds in your area, head on over to the Ideas Network Facebook page to share with us what you're seeing in your backyard. Coming up, we'll get caught up on sexual assault allegations against a Democratic presidential nominee. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, a new survey finds some student athletes face food insecurity and homelessness. Host Kate Archer-Kent and her guest look at the rules restricting access to housing and nutrition for student athletes and whether they should be paid to play. That's after 8 o'clock tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Now, our conversation next is about sexual assault allegations. It may not be suitable for everyone listening. Some Democrats are urging former Vice President Joe Biden to address the accusations being made by a former aide. The aide says it happened in 1993 when Biden was a U.S. senator from Delaware. The woman making the allegations, Tara Reid, says she was too scared to come forward. It wasn't until a little more than a month ago that she detailed what she says happened. And since then, witnesses have confirmed key parts of Reid's story. Some inconsistencies remain, and her version of the events has changed over time. The Biden campaign has denied the allegations, but Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, has yet to comment. Some members of his party say the denials by the Biden campaign aren't good enough. Other key Democrats and supporters of the Me Too movement are standing by Biden, and others just aren't saying anything. So our guest now is Annie Linsky. She's a national political reporter at The Washington Post. Annie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there.
There is a lot going on here, but let's start at the beginning. Help us understand who Tara Reid is.
Oh, yes. So Tara Reid was a kind of a low-level staffer who worked in Biden's Senate office in the early 90s. And when she was there, she alleges that she had sort of two categories of uncomfortable and sort of outright horrific interactions with the senator, then senator. She had said last year that he kind of inappropriately would touch her in public in a way that made her feel uncomfortable, sort of in the lines of sexual harassment. But what's new is more recently she has also added to that to say that she was sexually assaulted by Joe Biden at one point when she was delivering something to him, and that he had this this assault happened in the Capitol complex in a hallway. And so that is the more recent and really the more serious charge or allegation that's made against Biden. Biden's campaign has denied that that happened. But Joe Biden, up until now, has not said anything himself about it. Although, you know, we did just get news that he is planning to say something tomorrow morning on MSNBC's Morning Joe.
Okay, so that's certainly something that will be a development here. But Biden hasn't said anything about it until now. He also hasn't been asked about it, right?
That's right. He has not. And he has done a number of television interviews since the Washington Post and the New York Times did kind of detailed investigations into this allegation. He's done a number of local TV station, been on local TV in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, also Florida. He also has done some late night shows, which isn't always necessarily the right venue for something like this, but certainly has been in front of cameras since these allegations were detailed. But something else changed this week, too, and that is Business Insider ran a story where they had found some additional corroboration of Tara Reade's allegations. One of the difficult things about this story and about Tara Reade's accusations initially is that the corroboration was not as solid as it has been in some of the other high-profile cases that, you know, your listeners are familiar with. And in this case, that sort of corroboration was not as clear. This week, that picture changed somewhat with one of her former neighbors coming forward saying that she had remembered a conversation with Ms. Reade. A sort of television snippet of Tara Reade's mother potentially calling in to a talk show where she made sort of a vague reference potentially to this allegation has been sort of aired publicly in the last few days. It's sort of a tricky one because Tara Reade's mother, if it is her, is calling in anonymously. So you don't know it's her, and she doesn't use Biden's name. So it is a little bit tricky, but Tara Reade, when she heard the snippet, did say she did think it was her mother making that call.
And, you know, some of Biden's supporters say Reade may have had political motivations. I mean, that we're trying to square that with the point of the Me Too movement, which is to believe women and not blame victims of these crimes. Although people have noted that she was an outspoken supporter of Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. She was asked about some of this support that wasn't in Joe Biden's camp on NPR earlier this month. Here's a listen.
So this isn't a partisan issue. This is about, again, it's about power and the abuse of power. And then the people around that person that enable that behavior.
So that is Tara Reade explaining that. I mean, how are we supposed to think about this with all of this context?
I mean, that's what's been really tricky, particularly for Democrats and women who are Democrats in the party have been really struggling with that, with how exactly to process and assess her allegations in this moment where Democrats are so fearful of Donald Trump being reelected president, and there lays this very, very tricky tension for this group of people. And I think what the result of that has been a lot of silence from some of the people who one would expect, and also when other sort of somewhat similar allegations come forward, are quite loud and quite willing to offer their views. You know, as a reporter, I'm getting a lot of people on the phone who are saying, oh, you know, I don't know all the details, or I don't know everything about that. And it's surprising, because these are some of the same people who are, you know, are quite willing to talk in other instances. So there has been, you know, a reaction to this that is just a lot different than some of the other high profile cases that we've had over the last few years.
Annie Linsky is a national political reporter with The Washington Post, and you can join our conversation about these accusations against presidential hopeful Joe Biden. How do you want to see him respond? What do you think his supporters should say about this now? And how do you think this fits into the Me Too movement? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. And we've got Sharon from Milwaukee who wants to be part of this conversation. Welcome, Sharon.
Hi. My comment is, as far as President Trump and the Republicans, they've already set precedents that it doesn't really matter if Biden did anything or not, because of everything Trump has done, and everyone says that's okay, and everything with the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, and how everybody went after his accuser, and that was okay. That's, you know, that's the buddy system. So for any of them to go after Biden, they've already set precedent. It's a moot point as far as I'm concerned.
Sharon, thanks for that comment. And Annie, I mean, is that what you're hearing in some of the reporting that you're doing, where people are saying there have been lots of other high profile accusations? This is just another one.
Yeah, the caller makes a really interesting point, and one that particularly, you know, I've just been talking to a lot of women's groups recently as I've been doing reporting on this story, that sort of high-profile women's champions sort of gnash their teeth at some point are women going to be asked, and sort of, you know, women and men going to be asked to sort of pick for the president somebody who has X number of allegations versus Y number of allegations. And, you know, why is that balance sheet, like, why does that have to be the choice? You know, why do you need to pick between somebody who has been, has a record of a very long list of people who've come forward versus somebody who has a shorter list? And it's a difficult position that I think, you know, a lot of women's leaders are grappling with. And, you know, that comes particularly on the Democratic side. And just forgive me here, I've been focusing on Democrats for the last year. But on the Democratic side, where there had been so much enthusiasm about a historically diverse presidential field, where you had four women running who were, you know, quite credible candidates. And just none of them, you know, and six altogether in a serious way, but, you know, four who really could have potentially, you know, had the qualifications that we typically see in a commander in chief. And none of those four really took off in any meaningful way in terms of getting a delegate count. And I think that has been disappointing. And then when you add to that the sort of dynamic that your caller mentioned, which is, you know, some could sort of reduce this to sort of, well, Trump has X number of allegations and now Biden has an allegation too. So we're left with a choice that is not as sort of exciting as perhaps people thought it would be, is the view of the people that I've been talking to this week.
We're talking about the sexual assault allegation against former Vice President Joe Biden. Annie Linsky is our guest, and she is a political reporter for The Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Joe Biden needs to address this story, or do you think he should stay quiet about it? Does this story change the way you view anything about the Me Too movement? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. We continue this conversation with you here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Our conversation continues about the sexual assault allegations against then-Senator Joe Biden. Former staffer Tara Reid says he assaulted her in the Senate building in 1993. The Biden campaign has denied accusations. Biden himself has not yet addressed them. We've got Annie Linsky staying with us, talking with us about this. She's a national political reporter with The Washington Post. And there's still room for you in this discussion. You can give us a call to weigh in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Gary from Iron River is ready to weigh in on this conversation. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good afternoon, ladies. Look, it's a difficult issue, obviously, and I sure don't have the answer. But what's obvious to me is there needs to be intellectual honesty by parties on all sides, whether it's the Republicans, the Democrats, or the news media. And it's clear that there isn't intellectual honesty, that people address the issue based upon their political biases. Similarly, WPR and NPR have had numerous people commenting about Trump's mental stability, and nobody will talk about Biden and his dementia issues. And somehow—
All right, Gary, I'm going to go ahead and jump in here because we that accusation of Vice President Biden having dementia is not part of this conversation, and there's no truth to it. So I'm going to go ahead and talk about the first point that you made, which is a point that we hear from many more people, which is that people need some sort of consistency when we're looking at these accusations. We can point to New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was one of the most vocal defenders of Christine Blasey Ford, who accused Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault during those confirmation hearings in 2018. Also the first senator to call on Al Franken to resign from the U.S. Senate when he was accused of inappropriately touching women. And here she is when on a conference call with reporters earlier this week.
When we say believe women, it's for this explicit intention of making sure there's space for all women to come forward, to speak their truth, to be heard. And in this allegation, that is what Tara Reid has done. She has come forward. She has spoken. And they've done an investigation in several outlets. Those investigations, Vice President Biden has called for himself. Vice President Biden has vehemently denied these allegations, and I support Vice President Biden.
Yeah, she ends with, I support Vice President Biden. So what's the difference here?
Yeah, that's a great question. One thing that several advocates in this space point to is process, which is that this allegation has been such an come forward in such an unusual way. With Kavanaugh, the kind of claims were discussed and vetted through a government process, where a Supreme Court hearing. A confirmation hearing where the explicit purpose of Kavanaugh being before a Judiciary Committee panel was for these senators to evaluate his character and who he is. And they have sort of some ability to investigate. In this case, the quote unquote investigation has been entirely in the media. And that's a little different because the media, although, we do have investigative reporters, and the ones at The Washington Post and the New York Times are very good and have uncovered a lot of very good stories. They don't have the kind of subpoena power that typically an actual investigative body does have. And what you usually have, what often happens with newspaper investigations is that they become referred on to other bodies, not necessarily criminal investigations, but other bodies that have a little bit more power to bring in witnesses and sort through those claims. That is one reason that is being offered. Although, I think your caller is making a point that even some Democratic leaders will privately acknowledge is correct, which is there is a pretty big space here between, a very quick, instinct to jump on board when a powerful Republican is facing these kinds of accusations and a little bit more discussion about process when it's a prominent Democrat. And you know what? There are people that do, Democratic leaders who do feel uncomfortable with that. And so I think that your caller is identifying something that Republicans have pointed out and some Democrats have, you know, are too, but although not, you know, quite so loudly.
Right. Annie, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you.
Annie Linsky is a national political reporter with The Washington Post. Now, Adrian Lathan is one of the thousands of people in Wisconsin who's tested positive for the new coronavirus. Her father, Gerald Coleman, was among its victims. Now, Lathan is telling her family's story in hopes it will inspire others to take precautions against the virus. She spoke to Megan Hart.
Talking about the last 6 weeks isn't easy for Lathan, but she says it's important.
People really need to hear from someone who's gone through it, someone who's, you know, who lived, who survived.
Her story starts back in mid-March when she thought she had a cold. The 48-year-old Milwaukee native assumed she'd caught it from her grandson. Lathan works in the technology department at Milwaukee Public Schools. The district closed its facilities the same week she started feeling sick. Like so many other people in Wisconsin, Lathan started working from home. Then her symptoms got worse.
I was having shortness of breath. I had the dry cough. I was congested, the headaches, and I was aching.
About a week later, Lathan's doctor sent her for a drive-through coronavirus test. Since she has asthma, she qualified under the state's testing guidelines. But the pain became unbearable before her doctor received the results.
I couldn't take it anymore. It was just too much to deal with. So that's when my doctor had me go to the ER and he had them admit me into the hospital.
A chest x-ray at Columbia St. Mary's showed she had pneumonia in both lungs. She says she was connected to an IV and given fluids, potassium, and antibiotics. Later in the week, doctors treated her with the malaria medication hydroxychloroquine. Lathan spent 6 days in the hospital, only seeing healthcare workers. She called and texted friends and family. At times, she says, her headaches were so bad she couldn't stand anything other than absolute darkness.
I was in so much pain. It's a pain I can't even describe. Everything hurt except for my hands and my feet. The headaches were like a migraine times five.
Lathan says her condition was up and down. She wasn't placed on a ventilator, but there were scary moments.
There was one day they even thought they were going to lose me. And when I came to, the response team were standing over. They were standing over me.
Doctors sent Lathan home on oxygen when her blood pressure, fever, and breathing stabilized. Weeks later, she says she's still feeling the effects of COVID-19. Though a recent test showed she no longer has the virus. One thing she hopes people will take away from her story is the importance of maintaining their health. She says anyone who has the ability to establish a relationship with a primary care doctor should do so. Dr. Cece Sharma is a family medicine physician with Ascension in Greenfield. She says patients should feel comfortable reaching out to their doctors, even if they aren't feeling sick.
How do I keep my family safe? What are your recommendations? What about the chronic medications that I'm on? If I do decide to take some sort of immune boosting herbs, is that okay to do so? And those are all things that I think can be swiftly answered when you already have a relationship there.
Lathan also wants people to understand just how dangerous COVID-19 can be.
So the social distancing, the good hygiene, those really need to be taken serious.
The day before Lathan was discharged, her father was admitted to the hospital. Gerald Coleman was 71 when he passed away days after testing positive for COVID-19.
We had to say goodbye through FaceTime. That was very difficult.
Lathan says Coleman had health issues like diabetes and congestive heart failure. She described him as a family man, a proud grandfather and great-grandfather, a Vietnam vet. For the last 14 years, Lathan says he'd been mourning the loss of her mother.
That was the love of his life. As he would say, that was my best friend.
Now she believes they're together again. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And you can find all of our news stories and our conversations about COVID-19 on our website. Just go online and visit WPR.org/COVID, and there's a long-running list of the options that you can read through and listen to. And weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow, we're talking with a leader at Wisconsin State Hygiene Lab about testing for COVID-19. Testing is a critical piece of plans outlined by state, federal, and business leaders for reopening the economy. We're learning more about the goals and challenges ahead for Wisconsin's new coronavirus testing. Join us tomorrow morning for that conversation here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it is the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll get some recommendations on games that we can play during Wisconsin's Safer at Home order. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is Central Time.